Well, we pray as we begin. I'd like to do that even though Joe has to. Father, we do bow before you. We thank you for the beauty of the surroundings and Lord, just your sovereignty in the weather. Father, the coolness of the morning. And we just trust that you will bring us sunshine. And we pray, Lord, this morning for our children. Lord, some of them are having a more difficult time than others adjusting and being in a strange place. And even the enemy has, as Randy said this morning, has really sought to deal with us. I think particularly, Lord, of the family whose daughter is really sick. And I just pray for her this morning. I just ask, Lord, your healing hand. I pray you'd give Dr. Blankenship real wisdom and that he'd be able to mend that. Father, it's so hard to enjoy a week like this when our children need us desperately. And part of the reason that we even came is because we need this time desperately. And Father, it's easy to rage against you and shake our fist in your face. And we just confess that this morning. Pray that you would be glorified and honored the rest of this week. In Jesus' name, amen. The seminar notebook, being a dyed-in-the-wool instructor, you may want to put your name on it if you've noticed they all look the same. I'd encourage you not to even use it this morning. There's more information in this morning session than I will even cover. And I'd really, we're going to move fast. I mentioned last night you may come close to a cerebral hernia this morning. We're going to cover 50 years or so in about an hour. And tomorrow and Thursday and Friday, you'll need to bring it because there will be some things you'll need to fill in. But this morning, you won't. You know, I was listening to some of you come into the great hall huffing and puffing, and I'm sure you've been told it's the altitude and that kind of thing, and it might be. I saw a sign a couple years ago that I've just never forgotten. It said, middle age is when your mind starts making promises your body can't keep, and we're there. So but it is, the altitude will make a difference. It takes about 3 months for your body to manufacture the red cells it needs to capture enough oxygen. So I would encourage you to be a little careful about running back and forth. I made 4 one-way trips up to my cabin last night because I forgot some material I needed for last night's session. In case you didn't know, I probably smelled up here last night. I was so perspiring. So let me share a poem with you, a poem that has embedded itself literally. I suspect I'll carry this with me into eternity. It goes something like this. Who have I seen who looks after the wind, laughing and dancing at its play? Who have I seen who looks after the wind, the frolicking wind, every day? Who have I seen who looks after the clouds passing so swiftly in their flight? Who have I seen who looks after the clouds from morning till noon and from noon until night? Who have I seen who looks after this world with its domes and shiny halls? Who have I seen who looks after this world? I haven't seen anyone, no one at all. That's a very despondent piece of poetry. And to compound that, you need to know that was written by a 9-year-old girl named Sarah Lever, third grader from Whitewater, Wisconsin. And she wrote that poem 16 years ago. And I haven't got the courage yet to do it, but I'm going to probably soon call information and try to track her down. She's 25 now. And find out, what's Sarah doing? Is she alive? Has she become a Christian? Was that just an idle piece of poetry? It doesn't sound like it to me. That was 16 years ago, and a young girl who, from our vantage point, hasn't experienced enough of life to be able to be despondent, says she doesn't see anyone who looks after the world. Obviously, doesn't see God, and apparently didn't see a whole lot in the parent generation that looked after the world. That was 16 years ago, and things have changed, or have they? We're going to be together about 4 hours in the morning. And in the 4 hours that we're going to be together, 3 young people will kill themselves. 160 will try. 3 will be murdered. Second leading cause of death among people, young people, did you know that, is aggravated assault. 406 adolescent girls will become pregnant. And 420 or so will get the news that mommy and daddy have decided that they just can't stay together anymore. And that you're going to have to just live with the fact that we've made this decision and we're doing what's best for the family. One out of four high school students in the United States this year will drop out, never to return. Now, if you're from Minnesota, that statistic is very, very different. It ranked number one in the nation. 90.2% of high school age Minnesotan young people graduate from high school. Top in the country. But the average is one out of four. They've done all kinds of surveys and they've found that most young people today would rather be a president of a corporation than president of the United States. And that may not surprise us. Now, statistics you need to be careful with. You know that. You and I are old enough to know that you can do all kinds of things with statistics. But I think the truth of Sarah's poem 16 years ago hasn't gone away. As a matter of fact, I think it's probably gotten worse. And I want to tell you what we're going to do in the morning sessions. We're going to try to figure out what in the world would prompt someone 16 years ago to write a piece of poetry like that. Or someone in the 20th century, the twilight of the 20th century, to say the same kinds of things. And we're going to look at the fact that people are, young people are. I have dealt with, I wouldn't even want to guess, how many hundreds and probably well over 1,000 students in the 9 years that I've been a high school teacher. Yeah, I told you yesterday we have 130 churches that send their students to our school. I believe, honestly, that I have a veritable window into the church. Socioeconomically, we cover every gamut. Theologically, we cover every gamut. And so even in this city, even though this is a one city in the United States, because of the number and the diversity of children that have gone past my desk in the last 9 years, I feel like I have my hand right on the pulse of American youth. I'm not a specialist. I'm not. I don't claim to be. But I think God has put me into a very unique situation. See, the Christian Day School is the only Christian institution in the United States that has the product of the Christian home the most number of hours per week. I have most Christian high school students, I see them more than their parents do. I see them probably 10 times as much as Joe does as a youth worker. Although he has the real advantage of having his office in the same building as our school. So he has a unique opportunity. But the Christian school, believe it or not, has the product of the Christian home more hours than any other institution. And the public school is the same, by the way. And consequently, I feel like I'm, in a sense, I can see what's coming by what's already here. And so I feel like the things I'm going to share with you are very much a product of experience. A lot of study, but a lot of it has to do with the product of experience. This is not a how-to seminar. It's not. It's a how-come seminar. And you may come away with more questions than you had when you came. I think I'm going to provide a lot of answers, but you'll probably have a lot more questions. That's good. That's good. Our brains get kind of lazy as we get older. And but I don't want you to think it's a how-to seminar. If you've come to the conference with the desire to figure out how to straighten out a renegade child, you may be disappointed. That's not the purpose. It's really for me to try to provide you with the answer to one question. Why do American youth think and act the way they do? And there's a little thing I learned in seminary, and that's that if you take a text out of its context, you have a pretext. And one of the reasons adults don't understand American youth, don't understand this generation, is because no one's helped them understand the context out of which these young people are coming. And I'm absolutely convinced that you will not understand today's generation until you really understand the generation of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and the 70s. And if you're the parents of small children, I think you're going to see this week, you're going to have a real good idea of what kind of culture we are raising our children in. And then what Joe said, the children of the 90s, what they're going to face. So that's my whole goal, is to try to put this into context. You see, Christians of all people, we should be prophetic in our outlook. I don't mean hung up on the future. I just mean we should have some idea what's ahead. Okay? We know the author of the book. We know the author of the story. And he's given us some information in here. But what I'm finding, as a rule, we as Christians are the tail on the dog. We find out about things long after they happened. Roe versus Wade was decided in 1973. It's interesting that almost a decade later, Christians are waking up and thinking, oh my goodness, babies are being killed in our country. Secular humanism has been around since the turn of the century. But there was a flood of books that came out in the early 80s about the threat of secular humanism. It's like we live, I tell my students, it's like Christians live with their head in their armpit for 20 years, and when they finally take it out, they go, oh my goodness, we're in trouble. And then we react, and we come across to the secular world as a bunch of emotional pinheads who haven't taken time to study issues. But we're very vocal, we're rude, and sometimes obnoxious. Andy Rooney, who's on 60 Minutes, I don't think he's a Christian, but one session at the end, he talked about his views on various things. And he made a statement that I was walking through our family room and I just stopped and looked and it just hit me right between the eyes. He said, personally, I'm against abortion. He said, but I think I have to tell you that I like the people who are in favor of it more than I like those who are opposed to it. That's a powerful statement, folks, about our attitude. It doesn't look good when you smear glue on the floors of the restrooms and movie theaters because they're showing The Last Temptation of Christ or firebomb abortion clinics and so on. I think part of the reason for that is because we don't take time to be in step with the culture. We let the culture get to the place where it's so manifest you can't ignore it. Then we react. And I guess my goal is to challenge you to be like one group of people in the scriptures. 1 Chronicles 12:32, David was putting together his rebel army. He's pulling different people from different tribes of Israel. And it says in 1 Chronicles 12:32 that he got men from the tribe of Issachar who were skilled in discerning the signs of the times and knew what Israel ought to do. David put around him some people that were able to look at the culture, look at the history, look at the society, and figure out what was happening, and then give Israel counsel. Give David counsel. David, here's what you ought to do based on what's going on. And you know what? Jesus himself chastised the Pharisees for the very same thing. In Luke chapter 12, in verse 54 through 56, he says, you know, you guys are real good. Look, and you see the red clouds coming in, you say, well, it's going to rain. Or if you see this kind of weather, you say, it's going to be hot. He says, but you miss what's going on around you. And that's my goal for us in these morning sessions, is for us to become men and women of Issachar, who can look at the culture and know where it's been, know where it's headed, and have some idea, first of all, how to raise our children. Raising children in the 90s is not going to be the same as it was in the 80s, folks. There's a lot of things that we are going to have to do differently as a church. So that's my goal. It's not a word from the mountain. We're looking pedestrian level here, eyeball to eyeball. And I've done all the work. And seminars, I'm not real big on seminars. I think they're neat ways to condense a great deal of information down into a small capsule, and then you don't have to do the work. But the danger is that when you sit through something like this, you go away feeling a commensurate level of spiritual growth. And that doesn't work. That comes out in the warp and the woof of our daily lives. So what we're going to do this morning is we're going to shoot through history. And we've got a good age span here. So it's going to be kind of fun for some of you at different points of this morning's session. Some of you at the very beginning are like, what's that all about, you know? You get hit right between the eyes when you realize that they're teaching the 60s as history now. You know, when I first, our babysitter came and said, oh yeah, well, our teacher's doing a unit on the 60s. Teaching it all wrong, by the way. I was real frustrated to hear the way he's approaching it. But we're going to take a look at the 50s, the early 60s, the latter part of the 60s, early 70s, the 70s as a whole, and the present. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that history just falls into neat little compartments, okay? Unless you're dispensational, then it does. But I don't think that I can take cultural history and divide it up. What was going on in California was 5 to 10 years ahead of what was going on in Minneapolis or Iowa or Nebraska. It depends on various parts of the country. But I think there's significant trends that we can trace. Okay, we're going to start out with the 50s for a number of very significant reasons. I was born then, and it's very difficult to talk with any kind of certainty about something that happened before you were born. But we need to drop back a little bit before we get to the 50s. World War II had officially ended in 1945. We were living in the shadow of that trauma. In 1949, Russia had tested its first atomic bomb, thus dispelling the idea that the United States was the only world power that had nuclear capability. In 1950, we got involved in the Korean War, or the Korean conflict. In 1951, a bomb shelter was built in Los Angeles by a woman by the name of Calhoun, and it made the papers across the country as people began to realize that the annihilation by nuclear war was more than a possibility. They felt it was a probability. Matter of fact, I've got Roger Fleming, who's one of the men that's involved in the Navigator Ministries. I taught his children. They live in a house, and Jill and I were over there for dinner about a year ago, and they have a bomb shelter in their basement. And I asked him, I said, Roger, when was your home built? And it was built about 1951. So this whole idea of protecting yourself from the threat of nuclear annihilation began to become dominant, and people were printing books on what kinds of things you needed to bring into a bomb shelter. In 1952, America tested its first H-bomb. In 1953, Russia tested a hydrogen bomb as well. And this whole idea of the bomb began to become a dominant source of paranoia. In 1956, the Secretary of State said that we would go to the brink of war to prevent a confrontation with Russia, and that they wanted to stop communism. In 1957, Russia unveiled a little ball of transistors and resistors, and the first space satellite was launched by the Soviet Union, and the space race was on. And we have a whole generation of young people that are growing up with this. Some of you vividly recall the bomb air raid drills in grade school, where you had to run to a specific part of the building in case there was a bomb. But in 1952, something kind of nullified or neutralized this paranoia, and that was that Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon were elected to the presidency and the vice presidency of the United States. And they ushered in what Time magazine called an unprecedented era of material prosperity. Americans never had it so good. We had geared up our production for the war. We were producing and producing and producing, and when the war ended, the producing kept going. Number of forest campers increased by almost 500% between 1950 and 1960. Number of bowling alleys increased by 100%. The number of magazines that got started in the 50s is absolutely staggering. Sports Illustrated, all kinds of them. You can trace them back to this era of material prosperity. Between 1950 and 1960, the production of lawn furniture went up 100%, and hot dog production went almost 100% itself. The backyard barbecue got started in the 50s. Our kids growing up now cooking burgers on the backyard, they think that people always did that. And some of you remember that wasn't the case. You remember those little grills that always tipped over. Between 1950 and 1960, gin production went up 300%. Vodka production went up 1,000%. And aspirin production went up 50% as well. The cocktail party got started in the 50s. Some of you have come from secular homes and you recognize probably a scene like this occurring in maybe a recreational room in your basement. Most of them had bars. And our parents had all their friends over to drink and to sit around and dance and listen to a certain kind of music that we'll look at in a second. But there was a tremendous euphoria in the 50s. America had it good, and they were enjoying it. It was a time of crazes. A group of entrepreneurs from the United States were in Australia looking at a PE class there, and they had these bamboo objects they used for physical education. And being the bright, inventive capitalists that we are, they came back and made them out of plastic and called them hula hoops. Now, our children don't know about hula hoops, except they're starting to come back again. I would encourage you, if you want to try one in a store, make sure no one is looking because you can't do it anymore. My wife made a complete fool of herself at a store here in town. She said, oh, a hula hoop, I used to be really good at these. She took it out and the thing kept falling to the floor and falling to the floor, and finally she gave up. But this was the Wham-O Corporation, folks. Frisbees. Our children know what Frisbees are, but this is when it all got started. Scenes like this began to show up on college campuses. This was called cramming. I think there's 22 guys in that. The television series, remember these? I Love Lucy, Phil Silvers. Hula hoop, I used to be really good at these. She took it out and the thing kept falling to the floor and falling to the floor, and finally she gave up. But this was the Wham-O Corporation, folks. Frisbees. Our children know what Frisbees are, but this is when it all got started. Scenes like this began to show up on college campuses. This was called cramming. I think there's 22 guys in that. The television series, remember these? I Love Lucy, Phil Silvers, Lassie, Have Gun, Will Travel, Gunsmoke. Some of you can still sing the theme song from Have Gun, Will Travel. You remember that little chess piece on his calling card? And America settled down to spend a lot of time with a relatively new invention and novelty called television. Black and white, of course, but TV began to occupy a great deal of our time. And the shows were pretty much all the same. High morals, a lot of entertainment, and good fun. Emphasizing and reinforcing the idea that we've got it good. Music of the era, we had Patti Page singing the Tennessee Waltz, Peggy Lee, Fever, Harry Belafonte and the Weavers. This is just a couple slides of incredible numbers of groups that were, or individuals that were singing at the time. It was called pop music. It was adult music. It was the music that went on at the cocktail parties. Our children call it elevator music now. So the adults were living it up, and the adults really had it pretty good. They were grateful to be past the war. They were grateful for the idea of being able to buy a home and build a home. And I remember my father sitting me down, and he said, Fran, he said, I want you to have all of the things that we never had. And my father's intention was good. But I don't think he realized the impact it was going to have on the culture of making a pendulum swing towards materialism and things as opposed to some very basic things like values and truth that were really needed at the time. Well, that's fine and dandy for the adults, but how were the young people responding to this pendulum swing towards material prosperity? Well, I'm going to suggest there were three responses totally unconnected but very much related to the materialism in the youth, in the parent culture. One of them was occurring in the inner city gangs. And that was the fact that you had a group of people that could not participate in the pendulum swing towards material prosperity. They couldn't be a part of it. And they said, we don't like what's going on, and we're going to rebel in the form of action. And you had a tremendous upsurge of teenage gangs and teenage violence in the 50s, the latter part of the 50s in particular. In New York City alone in 1956, teen murders went up 26%. Auto theft went up 36%, and possession of dangerous firearms went up almost 100%. Now, I'll leave it to your own imagination and conclusion as to whether or not there's any significance to the incredible rise of gangs today. They're on the rise again. And I think we need to learn from the past. Whether or not we will waits to be seen. The whole idea of teenage violence and teenage gangs got into the media as well. Got into movies like Wild One with Marlon Brando, High School Confidential, Blackboard Jungle. Got into musicals. West Side Story was a musical about teenage gangs, came out in the 50s. So you had one phenomena going on, one reaction to middle class materialism, or the formation of the middle class actually, was we don't like what we see going on, partly because we can't participate, and we're going to rebel in the form of action. Now there was another group, very, very small, that was rebelling as well, but they were rebelling in the form of an identity. You had guys like Jack Kerouac, Gregory Corso, Allen Ginsberg. He's still around, by the way, teaches at Boulder. It's a recent picture of him. And they said, we don't like what we see going on in the parent culture, and so we're going to drop out. And the media coined them as beatniks. And they spent a lot of time in coffee houses, drinking herb tea, smoking dope, reciting offbeat poetry, and getting involved in kind of an Americanized version of Zen Buddhism. And their whole philosophy was, we don't like what we see going on, and we're going to drop out. Very, very small group. Very, very small group. Minority. Now that's going to change in the next decade, incredibly. There was a third reaction. And we have to ask ourselves, well, what about the mainstream of American kids? You've got a small group dropping out. You've got another relatively small group in the urban areas rebelling in the form of action. But what about most middle-class children of blue-collar workers? What was going on with them? Well, I think we need to drop back. First of all, let me paint a little bit of a picture of something that was going on in the adult world. There was a new form of music that was developing. It's called rock and roll. It was a combination of blues, gospel, and boogie. You need to know this was not invented by young people. Rock music, rock and roll is an adult phenomena, and it's perpetuated by adults. It's sold to young people. But record company owners and producers are not children. The blues had the idea of sex and romance. The gospel had a real emphasis on vocal harmony. And the boogie or the jug bands or the jump bands, as they were called, had a real stress on the bass and the drums. And the adults tried to get this off the ground. They had a guy by the name of Bill Haley who played with Bill Haley and the Comets, which they did the theme song for Blackboard Jungle. It was called Rock Around the Clock in 1955 or 56. Never got off the ground. A black group called the Chords tried to get a song going called Shaboom, and they couldn't get it going. And what I'm going to suggest is you had two independent things going on that ended up becoming married to one another. One was a large group, mainstream of American kids who were feeling uneasy about this shift in values. They weren't quite sure what it was all about. It was probably at a subconscious level. And you had a phenomena going on in the adult world trying to get a new form of music started. And what was needed was a catalyst. Something to bring these two together, where this could become a vehicle for the unrest of the majority of middle-class kids. And that catalyst found itself in the person of a 21-year-old truck driver from Memphis, Tennessee, called Elvis Presley. And he came on stage in between 1956 and 1957, released a whole bunch of songs, Tutti Frutti, All Shook Up, Hound Dog, Heartbreak Hotel, some of you know him, Don't Be Cruel, Blue Suede Shoes, and on and on and on. And he ushered in a whole new national religion called rock and roll. And all of a sudden, an era was born. An adult music that couldn't get off the ground on its own found a guru that also brought with him the young people close to his age. And from that time on, rock and roll has literally been a vehicle of expressing rebellion. And you can see that in the quotations of people who were dyed-in-the-wool rockers from the very beginning. All of a sudden, guys like Chuck Berry, Johnny Be Good, one of the classic rock and roll songs that happens to be in the Voyager time capsule I mentioned last night. If you want to see what 25 or 30 years of rock and roll will do to you, there's Chuck Berry today. Still out, still singing. Just saw a thing about a year ago of him singing. All of a sudden, Little Richard, he went from the pulpit to the stage to the pulpit, back and forth. I'm not sure where he is today. He's kind of a tragic figure. Everly Brothers, rock and roll became a dominant theme and a dominant rallying point for most middle-class kids. So the 50s was a time of tremendous euphoria. But the thing you need to realize, there was no focal point to the rebellion. And I think a movie of the 50s captured that fact. This is James Dean. He starred in a movie, and you all know the title, Rebel Without a Cause. And I think that's prophetic. It was a 50s movie, and you have a group of young people who are sensing rebellion, but no real cause, nothing to really attach it to. If we were to take a look at the 50s in review, the culture, we had agreement with the system. By the system, I mean the systems of authority. That would be the home, the church, education, and government. People were enchanted with life. They had resigned themselves to the fact that it doesn't get a whole lot better than this. There was a clean break in 1957 from pop to rock. You can cut it with a knife. It was that clean. But you also need to know that the music of the 50s was messageless. When Elvis jumped on stage and slapped his knees together and said, wop, bop, a loop, bop, wop, bam, boom, tutti, frutti, all rooty, there's really no heavy philosophical message there. The dominant form of rebellion as far as numbers was in the form of an attitude. I do want to point out to you that the counterculture was born. And by counterculture, I mean a group of people who philosophically are living their lives in opposition or antithesis to the parent culture. And that would have been the beatniks. What about the 60s? Well, the 60s began pretty much where the 50s left off. John F. Kennedy was elected. He said, we stand on a new frontier, the frontier of the 60s. A frontier of unknown opportunities and perils. A frontier of unfulfilled hopes and threats. I look forward to an America which will not be afraid of grace and beauty. His time in office was known as Camelot. It was to end 3 years later at the end of a bullet. A lot of debate over who shot that man. But Kennedy was an ideal of the hopes and dreams of America. I have a friend who said that when Kennedy was shot, he believes that hope in America perished because of how much was wrapped up in this man. But what about the youth culture? Well, they were still living on the wave, literally, of the 50s. The hot group in the early 60s was these guys. You probably might not recognize them. This is Brian Love and the boys, the Beach Boys. They've changed their style just a little bit if you've seen them recently. But almost all the songs in the early 60s were about three topics: cars, girls, and California. And they seemed to all go together. Jan and Dean, Little Deuce Coop, and songs like 409 and Surfing USA, California Girls, Soup John B. The list goes on and on. Everybody was singing songs about teenage romance, fun in the sun, and hot cars. And so you have this carryover, but something unusual happened, and that was that, as you would expect, more and more young people began to want to emulate the life of these rock and roll stars. There was a veritable explosion of rock and roll stars in the latter part of the 50s. Dion, Frankie Avalon, the list goes on and on and on. You had the Payola scandal and a lot of things that we don't have time to get into this morning. But rock and roll became a profession that a lot of young people wanted to aspire to. And consequently, they began to buy guitars. And in the early 60s, guitar sales skyrocketed. But an unusual thing happened is that more and more kids who were playing guitars began to write songs about things that were on their heart, things that were happening in isolated pockets of America. And pretty soon, music began to come out that wasn't typified by adult record producers. You had a guy by the name of Robert Zimmerman who left his home in the Iron Range in Michigan and transferred himself to New York City, changed his name to Bob Dylan, and had an incredible impact on the music industry because he began to sing songs that had content. The guy is still around today. Haven't been able to nail down where he's at. He became a Christian a few years back, released two Christian albums. I don't know if he got burned by the Christian community. We have a really bad track record of doing nasty things to people with notoriety. When they become Christians, we catapult them on the concert circuit and the speaking circuit and turn them into Christian celebrities without taking time to disciple them. And a number of them have rejected Christianity as a consequence. B.J. Thomas is one who I'm not sure where he's at with the Lord anymore. Dylan does not speak vocally about Christianity. If you've listened to any of his albums, particularly Long Train Coming, I think that's what it was, very, very powerful, powerful lyrics about commitment and discipleship. But they began to sing songs back in the 50s, 60s about issues, blowing in the wind, If I Had a Hammer, groups like the Mamas and the Papas. You got to go where you want to go. Do what you want to do with whoever you want to do it, babe. And folk rock music began to become a very powerful force in the culture, carrying songs about autonomy and freedom and beginning to cast blame at the adult generation. This is Joan Baez. She came out with a song about this time called Saigon Bride. How many babies must we kill to make the waves stand still? How many dead men does it take to make a dike that will not break? Pete Seeger was banned from the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour because he wanted to sing a song that was anti-war in its orientation. This is a group called Union Street Fog. That's me in the upper left-hand corner. I didn't always look the way I look today. And we sang songs about social issues as well, believing that music was a tremendous vehicle in a way to get a message out. And if we could say that there was no cause in the 50s, or we couldn't put our hands on a cause, we'd have to say that the 60s was a time when that fire burst into full flame. And buttons like this could summarize what was going on in the 60s. It was a time of causes, tremendous causes. And I'd like to highlight two of them for sure, and a third one that I think was important in the 60s. One of them had to do with some things that were going on in the black community. A black Baptist minister by the name of Martin Luther King Jr. began to preach the message that blacks are human beings made in the image of a personal God and they're entitled to rights, and that making them go to separate drinking fountains and separate restrooms and sit in the back of the bus is not what God intended. And it started out small, but ended up in 1963, a couple hundred thousand people strong gathering at the Washington Monument to hear him preach a message of nonviolence, and he maintained this until the time of his assassination in 1968. But there was also the violence began to pick up in Birmingham, Alabama, and scenes like this began to show up on TV and in magazines. And a group within the black community said, we don't want to put up with this nonviolent thing anymore. Guys like Leroy Jones, Stokely Carmichael, Eldridge Cleaver, Malcolm X, the famous Black Panthers, or infamous Black Panthers, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, they began to say things like, we got to wage guerrilla warfare on these white honkies, or that the only thing that the white man likes that's black is a Cadillac. And what started out as a nonviolent movement in the early 60s didn't stay nonviolent very long. In the latter part of the 60s, we began to see scenes like this in Detroit or Newark, New Jersey, where this young black boy was shot to death by a policeman. And the civil rights issue was one of the causes of the 60s. And if we said that there was no causes in the 50s, you definitely, definitely could not say that about the 60s, particularly the middle of the 60s. Second cause, obviously, Vietnam, a war that America can't forget. We can't even explain it. And I'm embarrassed to tell you that while this war was going on, I was wearing a black armband marching around my college campus while my brother was a second lieutenant, lasted 2 weeks in Vietnam before he got hit by a mortar. He's alive, but he's got a lot of scars on his body. But you need to realize something. Pictures like this were showing up in college campuses. And you've got a group of young people separated from their parents for the first time, dealing with a sense of rebellion from the 50s that they haven't been able to quite put their finger on, being with memories of their dad telling them about the bombing of Pearl Harbor and our involvement in the Second World War, and not being having anyone be able to tell them why in the world we got involved in Vietnam in the first place. And pretty soon kids start splitting and going to Canada. Buffalo Springfield had a song out called For What It's Worth. Some of you might even remember that. But one of the lyrics or one of the stanzas to the song, it said, there's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me that I've got to beware. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everyone look what's going around. Paranoia strikes deep into your heart. It will creep. It starts and you're always afraid. Some of you remember that. Talked about battle lines being drawn between parents and children. And if there's anything that divided families, it was the issue of Vietnam. And you had parents disowning their children and children disowning their parents. Vietnam was definitely a cause in the 60s. Now, there was a third thing going on that got started in the 60s, and it had to do with the war. It went from peaceful to violent. Most of you remember guys like Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman writing books like Do It or Revolution for the Hell of It or Steal This Book, encouraging young people to revolt, and that only contributed to the fire. And so you have Vietnam just fueling and fueling, and the civil rights movement fueling and fueling. And then you take a third issue added to it, PhD in sociology from Harvard University by the name of Timothy Leary. And he said, if you want to find inner fulfillment, you need to find it by the taking of drugs. And he made the statement that LSD is basically Western yoga. And if you want to find ecstasy and meaning and truth, you need to go inside yourself with the aid of drugs. Now, something you need to know that a lot of people don't know, particularly people our age, is that drug taking was an ideology in the 60s. It was definitely a problem. It was definitely wrong, but it was also an ideology. We honestly believed that through the taking of drugs, we could raise our consciousness and the consciousness of anyone else who took them and honestly find solutions to the world's problems. I had people that became Christians and wanted to buy farms in northern Wisconsin and raise dope and bring people up and get them high so they could share the gospel with them. Because they believed so much that drugs were the root to greater understanding. Now, the taking of drugs today, and we're going to talk about that a little bit, totally different reason, folks. The ideology is gone. Both eras, today and the 60s, it was wrong. Don't misunderstand me. But you cannot separate the fact that the taking of drugs was linked to a whole worldview, a whole outlook on life in the 60s. Well, it got itself into music. This is a group called the Jefferson Airplane, changed their name to Jefferson Starship, and they're still around. Grace Slick, the leader, named her first illegitimate child God, and then later changed his name. I was grateful for that. That'd be a hard name to live up to as you get older. Guys like the Beatles singing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. But drugs began to become a dominant theme in music. As a matter of fact, guys like Jimi Hendrix, it was pretty much a common understanding that if you wanted to appreciate Hendrix's music, you needed to be stoned. And his songs, Purple Haze, In My Brain, Many Things Don't Seem the Same, or Steppenwolf, Magic Carpet Ride, or Hendrix's album, Electric Ladyland. But the taking of drugs was another issue that was very much linked to the ideology of improving America. Vietnam and the civil rights movement were the two main focal points, but the drug taking was an ideology linked to those two as well. Well, if we look at the early 60s, we see some very significant changes. We have disagreement with the system rather than agreement with the system. We have disenchantment with life, and the resignation has turned to demonstration. Music is now carrying a message, a tremendous message. a message of uneasiness and searching. You have to see that in the taking of drugs. Rebellion was in the form of action, and the counterculture at this point was massive. It was huge. It was, in true terms, a counterculture. The late 60s. Well, what happens in the late 60s? Something very interesting happens. The music of the late 60s carries it all. This is a scene from a Beatles movie called Yellow Submarine. And I want to start quoting some lyrics to you to help reinforce what's going on in the latter part of the 60s. Sky of blue, sea of green, in our yellow submarine, every one of us is all we need. The Beatles were also singing, all you need is love. Love is all you need. Or we're coming to strawberry fields forever. Nothing to get hung up about. Carole King sang a song called Beautiful. She said, you got to get up every morning with a smile on your face and show the world all the love that's in your heart. James Taylor was singing, when you're down and troubled and you need a helping hand, you've got a friend. Simon and Garfunkel were singing, got no deeds to do, no promises to keep. I'm dappled and drowsy and ready for sleep. Let the morning time drop all its petals on me. Life, I love you. All is groovy. Or the Fifth Dimension, Surrey down to the Stone Soul Picnic. Or Up, Up and Away that TWA picked as their theme song for a few years. What was going on? There was an incredible optimism. A rock festival in upstate New York on Max Asker's farm near Woodstock, New Jersey actually, was proof positive to the youth culture that we could do it. That the peace movement could produce a new world. There was no violence at Woodstock. We got along. A lot of drugs, a lot of rock and roll, but it was proof to us that we could pull it off, that the counterculture could pull it off. It's all really caught and summarized in the lead song from a rock musical called Hair. The theme song was Aquarius. It was made popular by the Fifth Dimension. Let me quote the lyrics to that song, if I can remember them all, and I want you to listen to them now in their cultural and historical context. When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, then love will steer the planets and peace will guide the stars. This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius, the age of Aquarius. Now listen to this. Harmony and understanding, sympathy and trust abounding, no more falsehoods or derisions, golden living, dreams of visions, mystic crystal revelation, and the mind's true liberation. Aquarius. What had happened? The youth culture genuinely believed, that we were on the threshold of a whole new era where brotherly love and peace were literally going to guide the planets and steer the stars. All the protesting, all the shouting, all the sit-ins, walk-ins, be-ins, all the ins had paid off. If we look at the late 60s, rebellion's in a pause. There's a hiatus. It's like we're holding our breath. Music is incredibly optimistic, and the culture, the youth culture, is jubilant over what's ahead. It's beautiful. It's coming. But something interesting happens in the early 70s. The Beatles broke up in 1970 amidst a tremendous legal mess, and Paul McCartney formed. In 1973, the same guy that was singing All You Need Is Love in 1968, in 1973, he's singing a song called Live and Let Die. And here's what it says. In this, you used to say, live and let live. But in this ever-changing world in which we live in causes you to give in and sigh. Live and let die. Fifth Dimension was singing Up, Up and Away. They sang a song in 1973 called Ashes to Ashes. Dust to dust, we'll never be the same. We're all forgiven because we're only living to leave the way we came. Maureen McGovern. The theme song, folks, to the Poseidon Adventure was not just a piece of music. That whole movie was a philosophical statement. And the theme song was, there's got to be a morning after if we can hold on through the night. George Harrison, an ex-Beatle, sang a song, give me hope, help me cope, give me peace on earth. Carole King, the one that was singing, you got to get up in the morning every morning with a smile on your face in 1968. Listen to this, 1973. If you read the papers, you'll see history in the making. You'll read what they say life's all about. They say it's there for the taking. You should really check it out if you want to see what's shaping. But don't tell me about the things you've heard. I may be wrong, but I still want to believe in humanity. If I looked at what's really going on, I would lose faith and never could recover. What in the world is happening? Same groups. singing songs with a pessimism so dark you could cut it with a knife. Dylan singing ahead of his time. How does it feel? How does it feel to be on your own with no direction home, just like a rolling stone? How does it feel? What happened? Nixon resigned, the war was over. The things that we were against were gone. And you know what? The counterculture was an anti-movement. And anti-movements need what they're against to survive. Annie Gottlieb wrote a book called Do You Believe in Magic? She's not a Christian. And she said that when the war ended and the anti-things were gone, we were in trouble. She said, no can be shouted from a million throats, but yes has to be shouted face to face in response to love or reason. In other words, the war ending, Jimi Hendrix died in 1970, overdose of drugs. Janis Joplin died in 1970. Jim Morrison of the Doors died in 1970. The Beatles broke up. The war was over. What happened? Well, I think it's captured in a song sung years before that by a guy by the name of Otis Redding called Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Some of you remember this song. He said, here's what he said. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I had nothing to live for. It seems like nothing's going to come my way. Now I'm sitting here resting my bones. And this loneliness won't leave me alone. 2,000 miles I've roamed just to make this dock my home. He said, man, you told me to come to the West Coast because that's where it's at. That's where truth is. Remember Scott McKenzie's song, San Francisco? If you go to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair, because if you go to San Francisco, you're going to meet some gentle people there. All across the nation, such a strong vibration. It's a whole generation with a new explanation. He said, man, go to the coast and you'll find the truth. Redding says, I went to the coast and you know what? My problems came with me. And what happened, you guys, to the counterculture was that they realized they had no counter system. And it crashed. It cratered. And a pessimism of the darkest shade crept in to the early 70s. Depression, pessimism, frustration characterized it. Now what happened? Where do you go from there? Well, let me suggest that I think there was three possible responses to the collapse of the 60s failure. And the 60s failed. Anybody who thinks that the 60s is a success hasn't done their homework. Oh, there was advancements made for the blacks and minorities and so on. And some issues were dealt with. But the 60s was a massive failure, and I'll show you why. But there was three possible responses. The youth culture could have said, you know, we asked all the heavy questions, and we didn't come up with any heavy answers. So let's forget we asked the questions. Let's go back to the 50s. And it's all of a sudden Laverne and Shirley are on TV. Happy Days are on TV. Sha-na-na and 10 Years After, groups that are playing basic 50s rock and roll music are popular. Disco comes out. Now, why would that be significant? Because disco was the first serious attempt to get back to dancing since the 50s. Dancing died. Those of you that lived through the 60s, you know that. Music went from something you participated in to something you observed. It turned into a spectator sport. Still is. The whole concert mentality came out of the 60s. But disco was an attempt to get back to the dancing in the 50s. And it failed. Miserably. But there was another group in Britain that was more intellectually honest than any other group. They said, life is absurd. We're going to be irrational because life is irrational. And it was called punk music. A lot of young people don't know that this started 16 years ago. But guys like Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious from the Sex Pistols basically said, life is absurd, so we're going to live that way. And they began to dress like that. Groups like The Clash, The Damned, others began to sing songs about the idiocy of life. And they began to dress in a way that promoted that. This is Patti Smith. This 1977, that magazine is. They began to dress in a way that was just absurd. But you know what? They were sick and tired of hearing Mick Jagger from the Rolling Stones sing songs like Street Fightin' Man about the revolution and then drive his Rolls to the bank to deposit the money from his last concert tour. And they were honest. Now, the costuming and some of the philosophy is with us today in the United States. But one response to the failure of the 60s is what I would call irrationalism. Just there, we are going to, you know, we're going to forget that we went through the 60s. Let's just pack it up. It didn't work, so let's start over. And let's go back to the 50s era. And that's, you can't do that, folks. Because the questions of the 60s were unanswered. Now that mentality carried over into a second response. And that was, we asked all the heavy questions, we didn't come up with any heavy answers. You know why? There aren't any. So let's eat, drink, and party till our eyes bleed because we're going to die anyway. And so a focus on hedonism, the idea that pleasure is the highest good, was a second response, I believe, to the 60s failure. And you see a tremendous change in the nature of music. This is an album by the Rolling Stones called Sticky Finger. It's a real zipper, and there's something underneath that, by the way. And a whole orientation towards sex began to be dominant in music. Black Oak Arkansas, on this album in the early 70s, middle 70s, Flesh Needs Flesh, Bump and Grind, Too Hot to Stop, and the whole obsession with sexual behavior began to be a dominant theme in music. Elton John, an admitted bisexual, all of a sudden that's acceptable. Or Queen, a homosexual group. And so sex, pleasure, began to be a dominant theme. And hedonism, the idea that pleasure is the highest good because we're going to die anyway and there are no answers, was one of the things that began to become a dominant cultural theme as a result of the 60s failure. Third one was an emphasis and a preoccupation on the occult. The occult is anything hidden, is what the word means. But all of a sudden, a group like KISS began to develop dominant themes. I'm not sure why this is happening. Blue Oyster Cult other groups began to sing songs about death, suicide, witchcraft. This is an album jacket, Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, by Black Sabbath, 666, demon possession on this thing, a whole satanic thing. You see this, and this gets more blatant, but all of a sudden the preoccupation with Satanism and the occult comes up. Why? Because I think the third response, second one was there are no answers, forget it. First one was, let's go back to the 50s. Let's be irrational. Second one was hedonism. Third one was mysticism. Let's look outside of ourselves for answers. We didn't come up with any answers, so let's look outside of ourselves. You see it in music, you also see it culturally. Alice Cooper, the son of a Baptist minister, really involved in occultic themes and music. But Anton LaVey, the writer of the Satanic Bible, shouldn't surprise us, you guys. This was released at precisely the same time. 1969 is when the Satanic Bible came out. All of a sudden, witchcraft and Satanism are okay themes, acceptable themes in the United States. And something else gets developing that was totally anathema to American culture, and that's the whole Eastern mindset. In the early 60s and middle 60s, Eastern religions were irrational, and America was living in an era of rationalism. Matter of fact, Christians on the college campus in the 60s were criticized because they weren't rational enough. And all of a sudden, our culture is embracing stuff that's not rational. And yoga, you try and find a YMCA in this country that doesn't teach yoga. And folks, yoga is a Hindu word. It means union. And it means union with Brahma, the infinite, impersonal God of Hinduism. It's a way of linking up. Guess when Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the founder of Transcendental Meditation, does it surprise you when he got his foothold in the United States? You can trace it, and I've studied this, 1972. I believe there was a spiritual vacuum that was created in our culture as a result of the 60s failure that opened the door for all kinds of weird religious groups. A.C. Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada, the founder of Hare Krishna, 1972. And all of a sudden, scenes like this begin to show up on street corners and airports. Again, a response to the 60s failure. Sun Myung Moon in the Unification Church, the Moonies selling flowers on corners, 1972. I kid you not, they all got started the same time as the 60s collapsed. Victor Paul Werwolf, founder of The Way International, 1970. Paul Twitchell, this is an old picture, but he's a founder of Ekankar, which, is, believe it or not, is having a tremendous resurgence in the United States, called Ek, E-C-K. David Berg, founder of Children of God. I could go through a list of cults that all got started in this part. Believe it or not, the Jesus movement, same time frame. One religious leader said that the Jesus movement was a great awakening. I disagree. It was one part of a spiritual puzzle that was created by the vacuum of the 60s. A lot of people that found Jesus off of drugs in the early 70s left Jesus for something else. What about the present? How have these three themes traced themselves into the present? I'll try to go through this quickly. We're running a little bit late. But I want to go back and look at the irrational optimism, hedonism, and mysticism. And I believe these are the three dominant themes in the United States right now, and they are a direct consequence of the 60s failure. This is the culture that our children swim in, literally. Newsweek, isn't it interesting? This came out last year, 25-year, or the 20-year, excuse me, reunion of the Summer of Love. They know that the 60s impacted us. Let's go back now. How about the first one? How about irrational optimism? Addressed, the best I've seen it, addressed in a best-selling book by Alan Bloom called The Closing of the American Mind. Kids don't want to learn. They don't want to think. They just want a job. And he's frustrated with what's happened in our educational system. We're going to look at that in great detail tomorrow, how American education is failing our young people. Matter of fact, it's doing something worse than failing them. But you have a de-emphasis on learning in the sense of thinking. Getting an education is not the same as learning. A high school diploma and a college degree don't mean that you know how to think. And American minds, American people are throwing their minds away, and Alan Bloom believes that. But something else has happened. The first one, the optimist or the irrational, throwing my mind away, and the third one, the mysticism, are weaving themselves together in the United States. In a cover of a magazine that came out this last fall, Omni Magazine, but they had a lead article, Transcending Science, the New Mysticism. And all of a sudden, we're finding in America, Eastern mysticism blending itself with Western science. And we're hearing PhDs in physics making statements that sound like Eastern gurus, that they're coming to the conclusion that the Hindus have been right all along. More and more Americans believing in the whole idea of reincarnation. Totally unthinkable in the mainstream 15 years ago. But the 60s failure created a vacuum, a spiritual hunger. And folks, you know something that's tragic? The kids in the 60s were asking all the right questions. And some reason, the church was on a holiday. I had friends with long hair, literally, and I'm not joking, literally and physically escorted out of fundamental churches by the elders in the church saying, we don't want your kind here. I had been a Christian a week. But all of a sudden, we've got Westerners buying in to the whole idea of reincarnation. It's interesting, in America, you come back as another person. In India, you can come back as a sea slug. But it's real, you know, in America, you don't want to propagate that. That wouldn't sell. And we see this best of all right now in what's called the New Age movement. It's not a movement in the sense of being organized, and some of you have studied that well enough to know that. But we're finding Eastern mysticism and Western culture blending together. And this is an irrational step for the United States because it's not a step of reason. Guys like this guy, Purcell, that's a channeler. And all of a sudden, channeling, which used to be something that occurred in back rooms, you can hire this guy to come to your cocktail parties. He's the exclusive channeler for a spirit. It's interesting, he gets all the money. The spirit doesn't get any. But so the New Age is a blend of those, the first one and the third one. What about the second one? Excuse me, I forgot about this. This is a beautiful slide, indicating the Easternization of Uncle Sam. We're becoming a Western culture that thinks in Eastern terms. What about hedonism? This has become a dominant theme, particularly among American youth. I told you before that they'd surveyed them and they'd rather have the opportunity to become president of a corporation than president of the United States. They did a survey among high school age people and found out that they would be more interested in being well off financially than having a well-defined philosophy of life. In other words, I don't need a reason to live. Just give me the means to live. Serious difference between 1960 and 1980. And hedonism shows up in a whole number of different forms. The American ideal is for us to be able to aspire to this. This is the guy that's got it. Wall Street. Matter of fact, I saw a secular quote that said, Wall Street and Fatal Attraction summarize the two dominant themes of our age, greed and lust. Good little quote. Can have it all. Can have it all. My fear is that the church is adding to the list rather than giving them a different list. You can maintain a hedonistic lifestyle and go to heaven. You can have it all here and then. What a deal. I call that yuckies. Young, upwardly mobile, carnal Christians. I'm not sure what this does to some of you, but the whole idea that God endorses materialism, I have a real problem with that myself. I also have a problem with Rolexes and Mercedes and tinted windows on the part of God's servants. Secular community can see right through that, and they had a heyday with that, did they not? The opulent lifestyle of Jim and Tammy, that's a household word, folks. And you and I have to deal with the fallout from that. I have to explain to young people why they shouldn't live that way, even though they believe God forgives, and He does. And one student said, why can't I hop in bed with this girl? She's trying to get me in bed with her. Why can't I? God forgave Jimmy Swaggart, didn't He? Jessica Hahn had her teeth capped, breast enlargement, and a nose job. And she got dropped from that radio station about a month after she started. She's a tragic story. Exploited, exploited, exploited. How about our obsession with physical fitness? I'm half joking, but I'm half true when I say that I don't think God wants you and I to look like we're 18 our whole life. And I'm serious. I see people with these spandex outfits that glow in the dark or take batteries and working and working. And the preoccupation with youth. How about the Clairol commercial? Wash that gray out of your hair and become the real you. You think on that one. You think on that one. Cal Thomas's latest book, The Death of Ethics in America. The phrase in America is get all you can all you get, and poison the rest. And we see that. Let me just show you real quickly what's going on in America. Something when you make all three of the major periodicals, isn't it? Personal ethics have no bearing on public ethics. At least that's the statement. Why is it that people can live for themselves and no longer have a sense of duty to the public? We're going to talk about that tomorrow. You guys, the secular culture realizes that we're in trouble. Sexually, what's going on? Well, you don't have to study very long to feel like you know what's going on. Do you guys realize that every one of these problems is a direct consequence of the sexual looseness of the 60s? Do you know that? Drug taking? You guys, the behavior is still there. Ideology is gone. That goes back to the 60s. The abortion question. You know what? That's a direct consequence of the 60s. I have a serious question in my own mind, to be honest with you. If Roe versus Wade had tried to have been decided in 1963, you know what? I think it would have been overturned. I really do. Because there was such a passion for the disenfranchised and the lowly and the victimized that I think that some of the people in the early 60s would have railed against the idea of killing an unborn child. But after the 60s cratered and it didn't provide the solution it needed, everyone turned inward to self-preservation. And the whole abortion question is a consequence of sexual freedom, is it not? This next one's incredible because it shows us we've got our priorities a little bit messed up here. If you go up in one of the cliffs up here and kill a bald eagle's egg, you can go to jail and get fined $50,000. But we can scrape out uteruses at the rate of $1.5 million a year, and that's no problem. Perversions of sex, we've seen that too. Ted Bundy, good illustration of that. Geraldo, where would we be without Geraldo? How about in the area of values? We're going to talk a lot about that. And you guys, I am not quoting from Christians here. I'm trying to show you what people are saying. Greatest percentage in the history of our country of people that don't want to have children. I'm not saying you have to have a house full of children. I am saying that these reasons for not having them are pretty serious. You know, you have to, we're going to talk about this tomorrow too, but how we spend our time is the greatest testimony to our children of what's important to us. My question is, what are these kids, what's the message they're getting about how important they are at home? Next step, well, I think it's you and I. I think our life is on the line in a sense. Can I have the lights back up, please? So we'll wrap this up real quickly. The main point of all this was to try to provide for you a historical context, a flow of what's happened. The 60s was not just a decade. It was a direct consequence of some things that happened in the 50s. The me decade, which was characterized the 70s, of the idea of me over you, that was a consequence of giving myself to others in the 60s and getting burned and realizing that I'm going to look out for number one. And all of a sudden books are out, right? The Art of Intimidation, looking out for number one, pulling your own strings. How about the magazine Self? Okay? Look and see when that started. You know when it started. Same time frame. The me decade of the 70s was a consequence of the failures of the 60s. The 80s has been called the decade of image over substance. What people think you have is more important than what you have. And that's a direct consequence of the failure of the 70s. That what I have didn't make me happy either. So it's going to have to be what other people think about me. And that's the context in which our children are growing up in. The three roads of mysticism, hedonism, and irrational optimism, a sense of hope with no reason for it, are the things that our kids are baptized in day after day after day. And tomorrow, we're going to take a look. Particularly, we're going to focus in on that decade of the 60s. Two questions in particular. What did it seek to accomplish? And what were the consequences of the failure on our children? And then Thursday, we'll take a look at how that's impacted us, the church. Some of it you can already see where we're headed. And then Friday, we're going to look at what I mentioned last night, the lost principle of worldview, something that I don't think many of you have heard before. And I think if you apply it, I really think it could change our lives together. Thursday, we'll take a look at how that's impacted us, the church. Some of it you can already see where we're headed. And then Friday, we're going to look at what I mentioned last night, the lost principle of worldview, something that I don't think many of you have heard before. And I think if you apply it, I really think it could change our lives together. Tomorrow will not go as long, and that's not an idle promise. If you look in your syllabus, there's 12 pages to this session, and they get shorter and shorter. So I think what I'd like to do is just not take any questions right now, and we can take some time for questions tomorrow. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, I thank you for the ability to document history. I thank you that history is important. Thank you that it's linear. And Father, the importance of what that means. And Father, a lot of this stuff is just overwhelming, all these slides and colors and names and statistics. And I pray you'd help us to condense it down to an overview, a backdrop to understand the rest of the week. Thank you for the freedom to do that. Lord, to be able to gather in this room, no fear of someone busting in and dragging us out, to be able to talk freely, to talk critically of other ideologies. And I pray, Father, that you would make these morning sessions insightful. And again, for the evening, I pray for tonight. I pray you'd make that practical. For Jesus' sake, amen.